right, welcome to the don't.
We're supposed to have a clapper.
But I'm the final clapper.
I know.
All right, welcome to the Black Rifle Coffee Podcast. Kevin Reeves, Baker Levitt, and today we have Tim Lesser from Leopold. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for coming, man. It's awesome.
Appreciate it.
So, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where'd you come from? Where'd you grow up? We had a little bit in common over dinner last night.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're right in Oregon. Of course, I knew Leopold was out there. I just didn't realize proximity and Camas, where I live and whatnot. But
yeah, we're pretty close.
Yeah,
didn't realize that until last night.
Yeah, for sure.
I grew up in Washington State. My dad was in the Navy, and so he was on a submarine and ultimately ended up in Groton, Connecticut. That's where I was born, was in Connecticut. He was a sonarman. Came out, went to work for General Dynamics after that, and then transferred over to Bremerton, Washington, which I think a lot of people have cycled through Bremerton for various reasons up there. So I grew up in Bremerton. My dad's family was all from Wyoming. So I went back and forth to Wyoming a lot.
That's why you're tall.
That's part, maybe.
Yeah. Everyone that works at Eastman's, Ike is the midget of the group at 6'2"?
It's 6'2".
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So that makes sense. You're Wyoming. Okay, I got it. Yeah. All right. I understand now. It's all coming together.
Yeah, so I would go out there summers, other things, because the lifestyle is just a little bit different. Walk around, jump shoot foxes, work in a taxidermy shop. You do that in the Seattle area, and it's a little less common.
It's beautiful. A couple years in a row, a buddy of mine, former SEAL Team 6 guy, actually Brett Morgani, they upgraded him to what's the highest one in the Navy? He got the Trump coin. It was a whole thing. Roberts Ridge guy, but he invited me up to an encampment for a couple years in a row.
Okay.
And I take my son, and we do a prairie dog hunt. And just murder.
It is tough to have more fun than that.
It was amazing. It's an amazing experience. So big fan of Wyoming.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I honestly call that my home. Mm-hmm. Grew up playing sports. Was actually going to go to the University of Wyoming and play baseball for the university, but they cut the program. So Title IX, which was the kind of balance between funding for men's sports and women's sports, basically had
Title IX. It's scholarship for scholarship. So for every male scholarship, you have to have a female scholarship. So your football team is going to take up 85.
Exactly.
Title IX is great and wonderful, and it creates a lot of opportunity, but it should be sport for sport. It shouldn't be scholarship for scholarship, because 99.9% of all athletic departments in the country are funded by their football team. You know, so yeah, there's a lot of schools like that. I think one school had to cut their wrestling program, and it's just it's a big mess. Hopefully they can get that thing sorted out. Yeah. What position do you play in baseball?
I was a pitcher.
I was going to say that. You look like a pitcher.
How's your shoulder?
Yeah. It's good now. It's been fixed. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, pretty classic.
So you grew up hunting?
Grew up hunting, and that was kind of the end of the baseball career, if you want to call playing through high school a career, really fueled it. So I grew up, my dad would take me hunting. A lot of it was Western Washington. For those that don't know, it's kind of rainy, jungly rainforest stuff, real steep, rainy all the time, tough to glass, tough to find things. You just kind of bump into them. So we would hunt deer and elk every year growing up.
Roosevelt elk?
Yep, they were Rosie's up there on the western side. We would go over the Cascade Mountains and go over into the eastern side of the state, and then they're Rocky Mountain elk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. Washington, like western Washington, is like deciduous rainforest.
Yeah.
You cross the Cascades and it's High Plains Desert.
It's awesome.
It's two different worlds.
Absolutely.
It's completely two different worlds.
Yeah. But then you got that weird banana belt area near Squim, like that little area.
In that rain shadow.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, we found out about years ago, I'm like, I'm going to buy a place up there because I get all the benefits without all the rain.
Squimish?
Squim.
Squim. Squim's short for Squimish.
Are you trying to say Squim? If we're talking about naming cities in Washington, when I moved there and I got to Fort Lewis, everything's got a little bit of a Native American spin on it. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to go to Paliup.
But it's Puyallup.
Yeah.
I lived in Washington, too, for 7 years. Yeah.
So I noticed you had to say everything with a little bit of that, like, put your Native American accent on there, like Puyallup.
It's speed, because it's speed and confidence. Mm. You just spit it out. And then immediately move on to the next words in your sentence.
Yeah,
and
but
and people won't call you up. They'll be like, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm from Ohio. So when I go like Wenanche, or you go Wenanche, that's how it's supposed to sound.
And then you're in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I learned.
Yeah, Paliup. Like, where's that?
Where are you going? I'm going to the Paliup Fair.
So funny story. When I did an internship in college in I did several internships, summer internships in San Francisco. And I remember driving out there, and I had like a AAA, like TripTech map. This is before the internet and cell phones and stuff. and like this Tucson place. And dude, I was like, Tucson. Like, oh, that's where I'm going to stay in a hotel
I'm slow,
there.
I just figured it out.
Yeah. And then like, I was like an hour outside and I was like, man, I'm an idiot, dude. It's Tucson. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So anyway, grew up hunting in Western Washington.
Yep.
And do you do any hunting in Wyoming?
Yeah. So when I got to Wyoming, the timing was just about right, if you want to call it that. So I went out there, intentions of playing baseball. Baseball program gets cut, essentially. And my cousin's an outfitter in Wyoming. So now the time that I didn't think I was going to have, I had. And so I would go up there every weekend, whether it was spring break or Thanksgiving break or whatever it was, and ride with him. He had an apprenticeship program, basically, where you need to go through and learn how do we hunt, why do we do it the way that we do it, what's the best way to get your clients in and out of shooting position. So if it's spot and stock from a truck, how do you make that easiest on them? We took a number of kind of wheelchair-bound or disabled, physically disabled people, and so there were different techniques for that rather than me just charging over a mountain like I thought I would.
Right.
And so I got to spend a couple years with him basically just learning why do you do things the way that you do it? And from there progressed, got a guide's license, and spent pretty much every spare moment out hunting either for myself or for clients.
Yeah.
Nice.
Have any success in your younger years?
As a kid, we had some success with deer. Some mule deer. My dad was, being from Wyoming, wanted to go over the mountains. You know, we talked about the high desert. So we would go back over on that side, and getting into mule deer and elk was easier. But it's kind of restrictive in that without preference points and other things, you had spike only tags, things like that were the general over the counter tags, and did manage to get a few of those. But not nearly the success rate that I've had later, just as we mature and how do you actually do this?
Yeah.
Just walk around in the woods with a rifle, you know? And so he gave guidance, but he let me figure it out too. And I really appreciate that because once it worked, he would point out, why did that work? Why did we find them here? What are they eating? You know, things like that.
Yeah.
And so it was a great time. He was come to find out, he was trying to make it so that if we shot one on the first day, the trip was over. But if he let me figure it out over the course of 10 days, we got to spend 10 days together in camp.
Right.
You know, and so now as a father, you look back on that and, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. There's That's a purpose really cool. for what he's doing.
100%. Yeah. There always was. I'm learning them now. I wish I'd have known them then.
It's fascinating. Like,
tell me why you did what you did so I know.
It's fascinating, like, you know, when we're young and, like, we question our parents and our, you know, elders and stuff like that, and it's like, man, they don't have a clue. And then as you get older, you're like, I don't know that they were ever wrong once.
Yeah.
Everything they did was right and it had a reason, you know. Even though you were convinced at the time that they didn't know what they were talking about, you're like, man, I'm an idiot.
See, I try to catch my son on a hook. I go, hey, man, you know time travel's real. And he's like, what are you talking about? And I go, well, I'm 41 and you're 13 and we are the same person. You have all my frustrations, all my drive, like his little temper, all the same shit. I go, just learn from my mistakes. Like, listen to what I'm telling you, because I promise you, man, like, he doesn't want to do jiu-jitsu anymore. I'm like, do jiu-jitsu. You're going to want that later on. Or he's got a long-term girlfriend right now. I'm like, don't do that. That's a bad idea. Long distance, rather. I'm like, don't do that.
Yeah.
It's just funny.
We did the same thing with my nephew. Like, Gavin and Annabelle, they're like 12 and 9. They hate, 13 and 9, they hate swim team. Hate it. Like, absolutely hate it. Despise it with everything in their body.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's like, hey, there's no time in your life, if you live to be 100, where you will ever regret knowing how to properly swim. It's a skill that it'll benefit you till the end of time, and there's no downside to knowing how to do it. But yeah, it's fascinating how
they don't listen.
No,
they still don't listen.
I've been lucky. My kids are pretty good about that, but my daughter was really good about it, and she's the oldest, so we kind of got eased in a little bit there.
How old are they?
So daughter's almost 20. She's 19.
Okay.
She's in Fort Collins at Colorado State.
And, that's an awesome spot.
Yeah,
Fort
it's tough
beautiful.
To beat that. I was a Wyoming grad, so she kind of—I think she specifically picked out our rivals
because
we don't have another school in Wyoming. So the cross-border war thing is our thing.
Okay.
But Fort Collins is great.
When were you at Wyoming?
I was there from 96 to 2000, 97
okay.
to 2000. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, we played you guys. Georgia played Wyoming during that time period once.
We were there mostly to make sure everybody got at least one W on their roster.
Yeah, it was a big win.
But nobody would play us in Wyoming
because
the height, you know, the altitude of the stadium, right? We're at 7,300 feet almost. And so if you go there and the altitude catches up with you and you lose, you lost to Wyoming.
It's like Boise State. No one wants to play there because of that stupid blue field.
Yeah.
and it's just high and cold and all that stuff. But so finished college and then what?
So in college, as I was going through, I was guiding on the off kind of whenever I could, and sometimes when I was supposed to be in class. But that led into the marketing team and the sales teams from Leupold would be out there, various companies. We had lots of, you know, Bushnell, Bushmaster. We had a ton of industry folks and companies that would come hunt with us. But Leupold was there every single year. And they would come out, prairie dog shoots. You mentioned that earlier. It's a great way to test optics because you're going to shoot 400 times a day, not once, you know, on a bull elk or on a deer.
100%, yeah.
And so I ended up getting to know people over time. So I was doing that through those 4 years. And when I got done, I had when I got out of college, I had these visions of I'm going to go guide. I'm just going to follow the seasons around. I loved it. I loved what I was doing. So I was going to guide multiple lower 48 states and then with Alaska on top of that. And probably a good thing. Leupold reached out to me when I was just finishing up and said, hey, if you want to apply, we've got a position answering telephones and some other things. And that turned out to be a good decision. I just didn't have the discipline to get my income over 6 months and then have 6 months off of go figure out what you're going to do. I'm going to spend it. I'm going to, you know, whatever it was. I was too young, didn't have the discipline. So, yeah, that's kind of how that came together. I went and interviewed. They're in that Portland area. So came out and visited my parents, went down, interviewed there. And that started, I guess I started in 2002.
And what was your first job there?
I was in technical service. So if you wanted me to mail you a catalog or you wanted us, because paper catalogs were the thing.
Yeah.
So you'd call in and we'd answer the phone. I'd write it on an envelope, lick the envelope, mail it out to you. And
technical
then it was technical services. It was a lot of
technically it's service. I think that's what
that is a fancy name.
It is a there was a technical piece to it. So if you called up and said, "Hey man, how much does my bullet drop at 850?" We would help with that as well. And dialing was just starting to come into play, and some of those things. And so we had been dialing in camp. Wyoming's windy. It's wide open spaces. So we had set up kind of our own homegrown CDS dialing system with white athletic tape. Basically, we took we took good accurate guns, put a scope where you could turn the knobs. They were the old Mark IV, the M3s. So they were designed for a 308. You could dial from 100 meters to 1,000 meters on one turn.
So where are we now? We're 2000 what?
At this point, this is 2002.
Okay.
And those scopes were mid-80s.
Yeah.
But we had been using them for hunting because we could wrap it in athletic tape and then just keep backing up and marking exactly when we were center on our targets.
So you were essentially truing back then.
Right.
I mean, trying to,
yeah, we were kind of doing it with, you know, duct tape and baling wire. Yeah. We'd just back up a road that had the wind in our face or in our back, right, and just keep going back. But now if we found that buck or that bull or whatever it was that was out there and we knew the client could shoot but just hadn't. You get someone from Louisiana, hadn't been shooting, you know, over 200 yards ever. Now the buck that they really want is out there at 450 and the guy or gal can shoot really well. Hey, do you mind just using my rifle? We can take it right now.
Did you dial wind for him?
We would do both. Yeah.
Okay. And what kind of reticles are you running at that point?
At that point, they were TMRs. The TMR had just kind of come out, and that open center.
What does TMR mean?
Tactical milling reticle. Okay. So milled dots. Not to get. I'm kind of nerdy, so stop me if I get.
I'm super nerdy.
No, no. That's we want to hear this because I like a cross that starts at the top and goes to the bottom, and then I like a horizontal line that runs across, and that's what I like.
We'll just beg you just hang out. We'll just talk. We'll talk about.
I want to hear this because
we'll talk about big boy things.
I absolutely that stuff drives me crazy.
Oh no! Once you learn how to use any of it, it's brilliant.
But if you think about this, opportunities for that stuff in the South, the way that I grew up hunting whitetails on farms, you know, you'll hear something like, "Oh man, we shot him at 220." That the Southern translation, 135. You know, on a rest.
Like, that's like, you know, your mileage. No, my truck gets 17.
It's like you're
everybody. Oh yeah,
you're talking about like windage and stuff. Like we don't. That's not a thing down south. So I'm listening to this, and let's see if you guys can convince me otherwise. I will probably interject when you say something that I don't know what you're talking about.
You still don't have any sort of holds built into the reticles that you use?
I tried to hook him up with at least a windplex. So. Yep. You know, no, nothing on the vertical, but the horizontal at least has some reference.
Like 4 mile
and
an hour.
And he just flat out said, "No, dude, I'm old school. Give me a duplex."
Absolutely zero interest.
Wow. Okay, so we're completely opposite.
No, but here's the deal. Like, if your gun, if you the way I look at it, if you know you're zero at 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, and you just put the cross where the bullet's going to go, that's good.
Wyoming. I'll say it slower. Wyoming. Wind.
Now,
full value. I mean, you got
30 mile an hour sometimes
in Africa this summer. So you were talking about doing everything for your client, like setting up the gun and all that. So hey, use mine, it's set up, do this, do that. So in Africa this summer, I literally, when I hunt, I do whatever the PH or guide says. They're in charge of everything. If we're going to shoot this, the switch clicks on, game time. If they're like, eh, switch is off. It's that simple. I tell them, I say, hey, you're the boss. Whatever you say, I'm going to do.
Yep.
Wherever he told me to put that crosshair is where I put it. And he's a bow hunter. And I was, he's like, yeah, you're right by 3 feet. And I was like, dude, I'll be the first to tell you if I make a bad shot. But I was like, man, I'm doing exactly what you say. And then we got back to camp, and like Rad was like, hey, man, like you weren't like calling wind and stuff. He's like, no, I'm a bow hunter. And I was like, oh, okay, so this makes sense. So I'm going to listen to this little part of the conversation and just sit over here and see if I can get educated on this.
So back to the reticle piece of it. Mm-hmm. MilDot was what most people were familiar with in terms of having a more complex reticle when you go back quite a ways. And the intent there was they actually took the crosshair, which is they're tiny. So if you look at them, they're like the thickness of thread, you know, actually about a tenth of that when you look at them. And they would put drops of glue on there a certain distance apart, and it was used for range estimation. So if you knew the size of the target, I'm oversimplifying,
sure.
I think, but you could tell how far away is that target by measuring it. I know it's this big, and it measures this many of those dots.
So milliradian is the measurement, and then you're just equating that to, you know, the distance. And then I could back, this is old technology. Yeah. It's much different now, but you used to be able to go, okay, I know that is statistically this many inches. If I'm actually measuring, this is more not hunting thing. This is like hunting people things. But I could measure it, and then I could equate that to what I needed to dial into the scope in order to figure out the distance.
So you guys, before there was a range finder.
In old job, you don't have range finders?
Nope. Well, in 2003, we had the Viper. Did you ever see the Viper? It's about this big.
Okay.
And it's like not nearly as accurate as it is now. So it wasn't easy.
So you guys don't have range finders with you?
Not, dude, we're talking early 2002, there was old school Viper. That's the first thing I ever saw.
So that was the reason for the problem was you didn't know how far away the stuff was. You can get really good at it, but you and I can now, oh, that looks like it's 250, and you can double check.
Confirm.
And you true yourself quickly, right? Mm. Different lighting conditions. Well, these MilDot reticles were there to estimate that range, and then you knew what to do on the dial or hold over with those dots.
Mm-hmm.
The reticle that we used was kind of a next generation version of that, where we etch it on glass instead of an old wire stretched across a hula hoop that you put inside the scope. They were etched on glass and much more precise, and you could put more markings in there.
So what I'm taking away is that I'm more precise, and he's shooting with a hula hoop and some wire.
He is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, continue.
Sometimes.
So we started with that TMR reticle. Just picture, looks like a ruler, up, down, left, and right. Nothing off of either of those axes. And then we would tell people, okay, we would dial for the elevation, and the confusion, if you don't have someone that's worked with a spotter before, like a lot of hunting clients haven't, if I tell them you've got a left wind, I need you to, you know, push into the wind, they get confused. Do I hold with the right side of the reticle? Do I hold with the left side of the reticle?
Yep.
So back to your question, we would dial all of it.
Gotcha.
So I would turn both knobs. I wouldn't even tell them distance, because a lot of times that would get in their head.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get them comfortable and say, if you're comfortable, wherever those crosshairs are is exactly where that bullet's going to hit.
Right.
And that gives them the confidence, right? You were mentioning it as well. Hey, if you tell me to do this, I'm going to do it. And you do it every day, so it's got to work.
Right.
Well, and that's why there's so much that goes into, especially back then, the shooter-spotter dialogue.
Okay.
You know, obviously, the guy behind the gun knows what he's doing, but the guy on the glass is usually more experienced in that configuration, which is slightly antiquated at this point just because of the different reticles, and I could kind of run it by myself later on, you know, in the years. But like you said, if you say, you know, wind is right to left, that's confusion. So I would say, like, hold right. And so you're holding into the wind. So you had to make sure that you would practice. We would practice shooter spotter, talking into targets, and then how to, you know, explain the holds. And then they say on target, you know, and then you give them the...
Mentally exhausting.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
But you have to be able to...
And there's consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, once you got good at milling, you could gauge it. So when it was a faster need to get rounds down range, I could wag it. I could go, okay, that's about, he's about this big between these two mil dots. I know that's X amount and then shoot. And yeah. that's not getting into like first and second focal plane and yeah, you know, the rest of the mechanics.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's something to be said for shooting the same scope all the time because mm-hmm. everything looks the same through it. And then you get used to, okay, I've seen this 200 times before and I needed to do this. So quickly, for me, it's a coyote running away or whatever it is. He looks about this big. I'm going to need to throw that much lead into it.
Yep.
I don't like I don't like touching the dials.
So if you don't
so this is no shit. I am so protective of the scope of my rifle that I am absolutely terrified of anyone or anything touching it for fear of it getting knocked off. And when you touch the dials, everything breaks and is ruined forever.
That's not true. I've been running Leopold since way back in the Army, sniper mm-hmm. days in the Army, and it's a super robust system and always had. We start with the Mark V Vari X, you know, 3 to 10, 3.5 to 10. And just mill dots, you know, but it was awesome, super robust. You know, we had it on the M24, but we didn't run the M24s as much as you would think because the SR25 at the time was equally as accurate, and then we had them put collapsible buttstocks on it, suppressed. You know, it was a much more agile weapon, plus I had a 20-round box magazine plus one as opposed to, you know, bolt gun.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating to watch guys that served in the military, how they treat their weapons versus guys that never have. You guys just toss guns around. I'm like, it's broken now.
What are you doing?
It won't ever work. Like, what have you done?
I have straight up
confidence
seen it.
Confidence out the window, you know?
We're walking around, looking at the Hindu Kush in Afghanistan, and my buddy Jason Little had a severe case of diarrhea, and he's miserable. And we had done the chase up this mountain. It's icy, cold. We're traveling super light, chasing the Mongolian herd. We're walking down the hill at night, NVGs, the whole thing. And I look forward or look over, and he's just miserably kind of walking along and periodically shitting his pants, not to get too crude. But he's holding his SR by the suppressor like a walking staff, right?
Okay.
Which is not the best technique. I'm like, he's a goofy dude, Jason Little. He's walking, and he slips and just yeets that fucking gun, like, ass over tea kettle. It disappears, and we're in some steep-ass terrain. Pick that gun up. Not a problem. Worked totally fine.
Yep. Terrifying. Terrifying. Send me with my bow. Hey, hold this. Wait, I'll put it in the back seat. No. Hold it in the air when we're driving in the truck. Like, don't let it touch anything. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't breathe on that. Breathe the other way. You're gonna mess it up. That's awesome. So, anyway, I think I took us off topic. We were talking about
the reticle that you're using with the clients versus mill dots and everything else.
Dialing and shooting and some of that and how it translated back to what I was doing in the technical service role. Mm-hmm. So when I came into to that role, part of what was going on was the people had sales, marketing, other folks at Leupold had been out and seen when we were training people on here's what we're going to do if you want a prairie dog shoots perfect. Let me touch those adjustments. And same reaction. Most people at first would just smack your hand. Like if I reached up and started, I know how that would end for me if we were on a hunt.
I'd be like, new gun. This one's broken.
Yep. This one's always, the ammo won't even go through it now. And so we were running some of the engineering teams and others through, this is how we're using it every day. Mm-hmm. And we'd reach up and twist it for every shot on a prairie dog shoot. And that's not overly practical, but we were trying to demonstrate that this thing will do exactly what you want it to do. Mm-hmm. And that was what ultimately they said, hey, you know, the way that you're doing some of this stuff, would you mind coming in, you know, apply for a job here, and maybe you can do this on the phone?
Yeah,
which absolutely doesn't sound nearly as glamorous as brown bears and sheep in Alaska. But my dad has a good way of reminding me on some of these things. Maybe it's time to become a grown-up, get a real job,
yeah,
and mm-hmm. get something like a 401k started, start thinking about futures and if you have kids and other stuff. So yeah.
Stop playing around.
Yeah. Either get serious and start your own business and run it like a business, or at least start thinking that way. Because it's a sport, right? And his concern, I think, and my mom's as well, is like any athlete. What happens when you're 40? What happens when you're 50? Whatever that age is, there's going to be a point. Elk quarters are way heavier now than they used to be.
Yeah.
And so, what does that look like when you're 60? I don't know. I hope to find out.
Yeah.
But they directed me that way.
Okay. It's been so that was fantastic. Your first job at Leupold.
Yep.
And that was, 2002, you said?
2002.
How old were you?
I would have been 22.
Okay. And then what happened?
Life started there. So had a daughter on the way shortly after starting at Leupold and went through tech service, kind of came up, and they have lead positions mm-hmm. in there and kind of just helping push out a standard format. So if you look at a company that's been in business since 1907 and made everything from water level measuring devices and ditches and other stuff, fire finders for the Forest Service, up through all of our rifle scopes, trying to teach someone how to answer all of those questions had just been done by absorption. So we started kind of developing a program for where can I go find some of these answers. Otherwise, you come in the first 6 months is like, yeah, hold on one second. Hey, where did we, you know, and you're asking a buddy and, right. and everything else. So we started working on those systems and started drafting up what does the copy look like for that, and kind of that led into marketing roles, drafting copy for instruction manuals, things like that, web copy, and then ultimately transitioned into the product team, which is where the majority of my history since then has been. So I went over to basically product line management, and we break that up by section. And so started working on new product and how do we bring that to market? What does a customer really want? What does a consumer want? Mm-hmm. And just having that ability, I think, to know what people would call in on the telephone, because you get some crazy questions from bar bets to how do you pronounce the company's name,
right,
to extremely technical people that have got a degree in optics that are asking, how does this one little thing work on the inside?
That might have been us calling.
It could have been.
Well, I mean, the
definitely wasn't me.
Well, first of all, Leopold's customer service is like bar none, always.
They're the best,
in my experience.
Yeah.
You pick up the phone, you're talking to somebody, you're solving a problem, or there's a piece of glass on the way to you as you're like shipping a piece back, something went wrong or whatever.
Yep. Yeah, so that happened to me. So when I first like started making like some adult money, I was like, I'm going to go buy some really good binos. Because I remember growing up, like if you had a Leupold Gold Ring scope and a Weatherby rifle,
yep,
your dad was probably a neurosurgeon and you were super rich. And I was like, man, that's what I want. And I think it was like 2004, I bought a pair of like Cascades for like, I don't know, or 350 or maybe $400 or something like that.
Yep.
And I was like, man, I'm legit now. And I had them, and I moved to Washington in 2012, and I think it was like 2017, the reticle, the eye relief thing stripped.
Oh, okay.
And it wouldn't close. And I was like, yeah, I should just go buy a new one. So I was like, you know what, I'm just going to call them and see if they can fix it. Cause, you
I'm
know,
glad
this
you
is,
did.
Mm-hmm. I like these binos, and I've just had them for so long, you know, that I got a history with them. They said, yeah, mail them in. So I lived in Bothell, Washington. Mm-hmm. I mailed them in. 2 days later, I had a brand new pair of binos on my front doorstep. And I was like, I called customer service and I was like, hey, did you guys mean to send me brand new binos? They're like, oh, yeah, absolutely. And I was like, customer for life.
Yep.
Customer for life because of that one situation. Yep. And I talked about it on what podcast we recorded 3 days ago. Mm-hmm. We're talking about how important customer service was. And I was like,
sure.
I share that story a lot. Yeah, still have them. They're Melissa's now. I gifted them to her, so she uses them.
Well, that's awesome, too, because you don't assume, but when we would pick up the phone, because we're right in Lewis. You guys are, like, you know, right down the road. We're like, man, customer service is super rad. But to know that they're supporting, you know, the military warfighter and the civilian with the same mm-hmm. urgency is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the nice part, right? So if you look at the tenure there, not to go too far off, I mean, we have 30-some employees that have been there 40 years or more.
Oh, wow.
And so as you start coming down, you know, if you look at employees that have over 20 years of tenure, it's like 120-some. You know, it's wow. I may have the numbers off. Mm-hmm. But it really does come down to people ask, you know, what is it about that place? Mm-hmm. You know, you've been there for – I've been there almost 21 years now. And it's just you're empowered and enabled, whether it be the family or your, you know, chain of command, if you will, to just do the right thing. Put yourself in their shoes. What would make the situation right, whatever mm-hmm. it is? What information do they need? If you don't have it, go ask engineering. Do they need a replacement product? Get them taken care of. And mm-hmm. so that really, you know, being empowered to go do what's right is huge. Mm-hmm. And that's big with the family.
Yeah, well, and we also watching Leopold grow. You know, I've done long gun things for a while, took a reprieve, and then back at it later on. But you guys are always at the cutting edge of, like, the newest, you know, new hotness, you know, like the Mark VI, the CQBSS, like all these super cool optics that are giving you a better range and more versatility instead of the old, like, 3-5. Like, people kind of stayed in a certain genre, mm-hmm. and Leopold always had, you know, the new hotness.
Yeah, we're awesome. always trying.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people there. Not quite 100 engineers, but they're just churning stuff out.
Yeah. That's super rad. Are you ready to get caffeinated? Well, be on the lookout for Black Rifle Coffee's massive Veterans Day sale. Use code VETERAN for 20% off site-wide at blackriflecoffee.com. It's the perfect time to stop and grab some winter merch and America's best coffee that warms the freedom-loving soul. So roll on over to blackrifle.com on Veterans Day, and the sale ends on November 13th.
So you got into product development stuff, product side of the business?
Yeah.
How'd you like that?
I loved it. I stumbled a little bit at first because, like we talked about, me being a bit of a nerd, I saw value in a ton of different features, and I'd try to jam them into everything. So, you know, one of the first rangefinders that I worked on was like the Swiss Army knife of rangefinders. Lesson learned. Mm-hmm. You can overcomplicate it for, you know, the general use that it's intended for. But I loved that, just learning. And you got to have a little bit of thick skin, because nobody ever says you did really good on these 99 things. It's like, what were you thinking on this one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
And one so, all shit screws up 100 attaboys.
Yep.
Yeah, and but that's, I mean, that's the good part, right? If you go out and proactively seek that, it's a difference in mindset of I got this thing and I made it perfect and I'm going to tell you why, versus you tell me where it's going to break, where you don't like it, what's not going to work, why is this switch and or button or lever located where it is. And if we grab that and bring it back, saying I need more bad news, give me more bad news. Right. Where, how do I break it? How do I use it that's going to make it not work so we can think about it? If you make that mental switch to I need the bad news, I love it.
Yeah.
And so it's been really good for me.
And how long were you in that role?
I've been in product, I guess, since 2012, about 10 years.
And then what's your job now?
So I'm the vice president of product and marketing. So okay. Product development and then the marketing team.
How do you like that?
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're trying to get a little closer on the front end so that we're talking to consumers and bringing that same voice of the customer, the consumer, mm-hmm. into the marketing materials and really making sure that the design intent, for example, is being relayed appropriately. Mm-hmm. So everything we make has a design intent.
Okay.
Whether, you know, Mark V, for example, can you hunt with it? Absolutely. But that's not why we built it.
You can,
people hunt with them all the time, and they work great for that.
Mm-hmm.
But we were looking at other scenarios. How's this going to work well for military and long-range kind of precision shooting?
Yeah, purpose-driven.
Hunt with it all you want, but you've got a few features in there, a little bit larger main tube, larger dials that, you know, you can dial farther that weigh a little bit more and cost a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead and hunt with it. It'll do the job fantastic.
So you started there in the very beginning of the GWAT, Global mm-hmm. War on Terror. Mm-hmm. How did that change the game for Leupold, like with regards to, okay, you're getting calls from Joe Schmo, you know, who's shooting whitetails at 100 yards, to I'm sure you guys got calls from, you know, guys like him and his previous job. Like, how did you guys set up that? Like, I'm sure the phone started, there's a lot more military tactical inquaries.
Yeah, there was. And what ends up happening, so as a general statement, we try to take whatever the cutting edge technology would be, whatever the need is, you know, and for now it's kind of longer shooting. It's not jungle warfare per se, mm-hmm. right? And then have that technology trickle down through the hunting
mm-hmm.
product.
Yeah, because if it works overseas in Afghanistan and Iraq, it absolutely is going to work for deer and elk.
Do you think it drove 100%. Innovation for Leupold?
I watched it happen.
Yeah.
So we would get phone calls, and, you know, some of this is kind of locked away in some of the vaults, but there were projects that, hey, we got 30 days before we leave, and we need 200 of this spec,
mm-hmm.
and we'd never built one, not one ever. And so, you know, we've got folks that are out talking to the procurement agencies, and what do these guys need? But we'd get a phone call. Normally a rifle scope project, by the time we go through and do everything, may take over a year, in some cases two or three,
mm-hmm.
just to get everything right. But it was fun to watch. For me, I was brand new, right? And so I'm coming from tumbleweeds and other stuff, chasing antelope around, to a pretty serious business mindset around military focus. And the phone call comes in, and Jim Siegfried was a guy that worked for us and did a lot of the military business development. He was a Green Beret as well. And he came over and basically called everybody together and said, we got 30 days to create this scope.
Mm-hmm.
All I have is a spec sheet and what it needs to do. Go.
Can you say which one it is?
It was the TS-30. It actually came out, would have been the Mark IV MRT.
Okay.
So it was a 2.5 to 8
mm-hmm.
With dials on it, so M2 type dials. But the original initial one that went out was a 3 to 9, and it had an eyepiece on it for shorter eye relief because we're trying to get the scope way back, so nose on the charging handle type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so the TS-30A2 was what it was. And technically TS stands for tactical scope.
Yep.
After we shut this down, I can tell you what it really means.
All right. but that's got to be motivating. It's like, you
oh,
know,
it's great. It's a rally cry.
You know, it's
sure.
like I have this saying, like, just because you didn't serve doesn't mean you can't serve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's different levels of service. Like, you know, I'm 45 now. I can do stuff to help. So, like, my service is now starting by helping with all our veteran causes and stuff. And that's got to be pretty motivating to get a call from one of these special government, as a non-military guy, getting a call from, like, a special government, like a Jason Bourne's on the phone type thing. And it's got to be motivating. You know
what
I mean?
Jason?
Like, it's like, hey, man, this is real serious. Like, I could imagine some guy saying, like, hey, we need 20 scopes for elk hunt. You're like, I'm sure you do. But versus, like, hey, these are going to go protect our guys and help them do their jobs.
There's got to be stress involved with that, too. You know, you're putting out basically a brand new product that you haven't, you know, tested and done all the things. You're going on the empirical knowledge and quality of the products beforehand. But to put that out there, yeah, is like, oof, all right, let's get it done.
Well, it's an interesting thing because it's something, you know, when there's a good cause, when none of us mind working through the night, working 3-4 days straight, whatever it is, if you know why you're doing it. Mm-hmm. And with this particular thing, it just shifted resources. So we can take in our model shop, we can take a literal napkin drawing, 3D print it, put some lenses in it, see if it works, machine it out of metal. We can do all of that really quickly. The hard part, honestly, is making it production ready later so that when you're running, you know, an entire product line through the factory and no one's watching, does the right O-ring go with the right reticle with the right adjustment cap with no one paying attention? That's the hard part, making sure that it happens right the first time, every time. But if we can get in there and get hands on it, you can do stuff really fast. And so in that 30 days, we were able to go through, build it from the ground up. We had to use some existing parts, glass and other things. The lead times are just longer. Run it through coating chambers and stuff. But use existing prescriptions, use different mechanics, redesign the mechanics all the way from the ground up, put it together, freeze it, bead it, drop it, impact test, all those things in 28 days, got them built, got them shipped out, and off they went.
Fuck yeah, that's a win.
And so now it's awesome.
Right? What year was this?
I'd have to go back and look. It feels like it was 2004-ish.
Before Instagram. Mm-hmm. Hey guys, can we get some photos for Instagram?
Yeah.
Preferably in use.
No.
What's
can't.
Instagram? Yeah.
That's awesome. It's been really interesting just to see the evolution of the reticles too. I remember at one point, I feel like Leopold, I think we sent back some glass because there was, not sent back, but we wanted reticles changed.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys like turned them around straight away. You know, took a piece of glass because the reticle game, the applied ballistics, like all that stuff was kind of catching up. And like, oh yeah, just send them in. We'll just swap them out. I'm like, that's possible. I don't even know how the fuck you do that.
It's nice because when you build it all there, all you're doing is changing one component.
It sounds super easy to you, but it looks like a space machine to me. I'm like, I don't know how to get inside of it. I just want the reticle to look different and everything else stay the same.
It's phenomenal because I've toured the factory a couple of times and like you see this like silver block and you're like, that turns into a scope. Like, oh yeah, and it's like,
that's so
how
cool.
Do you do that? Like, how does this work? And they put it in this weird space machine that blasts water on stuff.
Yep.
And it's and then you have a tube, and you're like, holy shit! Wow.
That's the
part. I thought the stork delivered these things, man. Like,
that's why this story is cool because some operator went, I need this.
Yep.
I do it all the time. I'm like, well, I have this idea. When it comes to manufacturing, I have no fucking clue how to even conceptualize. And you're like, oh, no, we just beep it bop and test it and crush it. I'm like, well, that's why I'm Ian. I'm stupid.
Yeah, I was at a Brandon Maddox and I went over and talked to the CEO of Silencer Co. at their Silencer Co. here in Utah. And he took us through their factory. And I was like, oh, I've seen some of these machines before at Leupold. And, like, they have these, like, you know, you guys have silver blocks or whatever, you know, that's what color they are. And they have the tubes. And it's just, like, watching these machine works. It's just, it absolutely, because my brain doesn't work that way. And it's just fascinating to me, man. Like, you get a phone call and someone mails you a napkin. And then all of a sudden, 28 days later, you've got guys going overseas with a product you made specifically for them. That's fascinating to me.
It is outstanding.
It's amazing.
Well, thanks for all the glass over the years. I appreciate it.
We're happy to do it. We're here, and that's basically that is what. So, when anybody walks through the door, whether they're hunter, shooter, not everybody is. You know, sales, marketing, some of those departments. It really helps. You need to be a hunter and a shooter to understand this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But not every department is that required. But every day that you walk into that factory, you're doing something epic for somebody, right? These epic moments for me, it's out in the field, my son, my daughter, et cetera. For other folks, they're a completely different type of epic, but it gives everybody a reason to do their best work every single day. You don't know where this one's going.
Well, yeah, right? That's
cool.
Yep.
And then when did Bruce get there? Bruce Pettit is the CEO.
He is.
A buddy of mine. I really like Bruce a lot.
And I may mess this up by year. I think it was 2013.
Okay.
Hmm.
And how was that change?
So I was actually not at Leupold when that happened.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So I had gone back to Wyoming to help a family company. There was a rifle company that was out there, and timing just kind of felt right for that. And so I had left and had been there not very long, a month or so, when Bruce was hired on. And I remember going back and looking at resume and, you know, just some of those things. I'm pretty invested in the company at this point, even though I don't technically work there right now. And looked at everything and was kind of like, that's going to be a good thing. I might be missing out, right? Hmm. And then ended up at some of the same trade shows, whether it be the NRA show or NESGW, which is our wholesaler show, and got to see him in action with the group. And then I was, to be honest, disappointed. It was like, I made the wrong call. I made the wrong decision.
It's interesting. Like,
fortunately, I got a chance to come back.
It says a lot about a company. We had Brett Voorhees on here the other day. And Brett went from Crimson Trace to Leupold, Leupold to Walther. He was at Walther for 7 years before he took over as CEO of Taurus.
Yep.
And, like, when you hear someone that left a company and they still speak really highly of it, like in your case, like you left and you're like, you still love the brand and the company and stuff. That's actually cool. I think that's a big testament to like what they have going on there. That's actually interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Little known fact, I actually went to a party at the president of Leupold's house.
Really?
Yeah. So the Northwest Defense Alliance was a thing. I don't know if it's still a thing.
Yep.
And they reached out and they wanted some, you know, the pinnacle user. They had reached out to the my unit. It was like, hey, you want to go? Just field questions from folks. So the Northwest Defense Alliance was basically a conglomerate of companies that supported the military in some way, shape, or form. Leupold, obviously, optics and everything else.
Nope.
Could be a fiber optic company. And they flew in a chef from New York. They flew in a cigar, like the humidor, the whole thing, like cigar night. Not a cigar guy, but it was fantastic. Yeah, it was rad.
Was that in what was up in Whidbey Island?
No, it was, I don't remember exactly where. It was just off of the 205, and it was east of the 205.
Okay. Yeah, so it was there in Oregon. I wasn't sure. I was trying to figure out what time frame, which CEO it might have been.
So it was around 2009-ish.
So it was before Bruce.
Yeah. Okay.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
It was epic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Super cool.
The thing that's interesting about Bruce is how Bruce had done really well in two previous companies he'd bought and sold, like Airwalk and Brooks Running.
Yeah, Brooks Running.
Brooks Running and Airwalk. And he was, like, retired, sort of. And he was, it was like, I might get this part wrong, but he was at his house in Colorado flipping through, I think, like a magazine or something, and saw, like, a one-inch by one-inch ad for the CEO job for Leupold. And he was like, maybe I'll apply. He's been there 8 years. Yeah, it's great.
That's funny.
Yeah. So you go back to Leupold.
Fax it on in. Yeah. Yeah, so I go back and work for Bruce, you know, so I got a chance to spend time with him at these shows and just, I was kicking myself just a little bit. And then we met up one time and he essentially said, hey, I'm looking to make some adjustments here. What are your thoughts, et cetera. Turned out it was a job interview that I didn't realize was the case. I was just trying to help the company, you know? And so he invites me back and came in as in charge of product development. So I was a director of product development, which was all of the engineering. So R&D, design engineering, which for us is like mechanics, wrapping metal around it, electronics engineering, optical engineering, and then manufacturing engineering. So we have to make sure all that flows through and does what it needs to, along with product line management, project management, kind of everything that goes on with a new product.
Mm-hmm. Did you get your degree in engineering?
No, education major. I was an education major.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you obviously have an engineering brain.
I tend that way. My wife would tell you that I am. The engineers would tell you that I'm not.
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough.
That's good. So, when did you go back to Leupold? What year?
2014.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah, timeline, shmine line. Yeah.
Yeah, all said and done, I was gone about 8 months.
Okay.
So it was when we talked and he says, "Would you be interested?" And it was kind of, he wasn't even done yet. I was like, "Yes."
Right.
You know, cuz
that's cool.
The reason that I had decided to go over to the other company had kind of taken care of itself. We'd helped get some things squared away. Everything was, you know, it was fantastic timing. I just got very fortunate there.
All right. So now let's talk about the real reason you're here. So if you're from Oregon, please pay attention now. All right. What do you got? What is this?
Yeah. So the biggest thing that I wanted to at least touch on here is we have a ballot measure in Oregon. It affects the entire state. It's measure 114, measure 114, and it's been named this Reduction in Gun Violence Act. And they're playing on the emotional piece that goes along with gun violence and saying that this will stop gun violence, but stating no facts. And so really what it does is creates a permit to purchase program. So you need to have a gun permit in order to purchase it. You need to go to your local chief law enforcement, so your sheriff or your chief of police, pass a live fire test, which doesn't exist. There's no system for this. And then there's, you still do the normal background check and a number of other things. It bans high capacity magazines, 10 rounds or more, et cetera. But really what's happening behind the scenes on this is it will stop all the gun sales in Oregon because there's not a system to go do any of these tests. And it could, if immediately goes into effect, there isn't a process to do it. And law enforcement agencies are saying this will take a year or more to even get it stood up and ready to go. Their concern, and for the most part, is this is going to take law enforcement off of the streets and turn them into administration. Right? They'll be in there administering permits and watching you go through a live fire test and a number of other things. And so when you go through and look at it, all the conservation agencies are against it. You look at Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, et cetera. And that, to some people, kind of catches them like, well, why would the conservation groups worry too much about this? It's really related to, A, we want sportsmen and women out there hunting. Hunting really is conservation, right?
That's 100%.
Where the dollars come in. But if you take an entire state, like Oregon, out of the gun purchasing pool, the Pittman-Robertson Act is basically a and I don't know how familiar this audience is with that, but
to explain it.
So when you go in and purchase any firearm or firearm related products, you've got this. I'm going to look up the year. I actually wrote it down here, but the Pittman-Robertson Act, it's an excise tax. So as you buy a gun or something else, a portion of that is directed over to state wildlife funds. So started in 1937, and that's really a driving force for where we see all the wildlife that's out there. So hunters and shooters equally should be concerned about this and go read up on it, because it's really it's aimed at stopping gun sales.
So just let me add on to the Pittman-Robertson Act thing. Yeah. So every time a firearm or firearm-related product is purchased, whether it be a 9mm pistol,
yep,
308 pistol, ammo, I think it's 10% of all sales, holsters, all that stuff,
yeah,
optics, everything, 10% goes to conservation. So the hunting, the conservation component is massive. It's billions of dollars a year,
mm-hmm,
that firearms and firearm-related product sales contribute to conservation. So it's basically we're self-funding ourselves.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you know, one thing that's actually really interesting is, like, things like this, it's just what they tend to do is they don't focus, like with wildlife stuff, like banning different types of hunting. These types, yep, of people that put these things forward, they don't focus on the core. They pick off stuff on the circle. So in Washington State, bear hunting with dogs, cougars with dogs, they get rid of those. And they start working their way in. And then once they hit on one thing, they don't stop. So in 2020, Canada banned assault rifles. This week, 2 years later, Canada banned pistols.
Yep.
So that these people, they don't stop. And when you give them an inch, they take a mile, and they realize that they can get more and more, and they just keep chipping away and chipping away and chipping away. And I think it is absolutely insane. And if you just look historically at the countries and places where firearms have been outlawed and banned, where the general population is not allowed to have them,
yeah,
look at where those things have taken place. And then look at those countries and tell me if you want to live there.
Well, it's a very passive-aggressive approach. People, if they don't really understand it, so that's why I appreciate you putting it out, they're not going to understand the trickle effect of what happens. Like, where do you draw the line? Number one, I have the right to bear arms. Number two, all the money that goes back to conservation, they're not thinking about that. It sounds like a good idea. Oh, it's a little safer. But if the system's not in place, you said maybe a year. It could be two. It could be three. That means, yep, that I can't have, if I'm an Oregon resident, I can't have a weapon system that I need to go hunt for whatever purpose or sport or anything else.
You don't have to have a reason.
No, I absolutely, you know what I mean? Don't. But I'm just saying you're taking away my right very, very passive aggressive.
Right. So if you look at suppressors, silencers.
Yeah.
And the reason the trust thing came about was sheriffs had to sign off on you getting a suppressor. And then sheriffs all got together and said, we're not signing off on these things anymore. And that's why the whole trust thing. Brandon was explaining that to us as well.
Okay.
So when you start to add in like training, shooting courses, sheriff signing off on stuff, you're opening them up to liability. And they're just it's
across
just,
the board. Yeah.
Ultimately, the purpose of this bill is to just get rid of guns.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear about it. It's named the Reduction in Gun Violence Act. On the surface, I don't want to speak for everyone, but I think we would all be against reducing gun violence on our people, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're going after this emotional piece. It addresses none of the reasons that gun violence actually occurs, though.
Agreed.
And that's the piece. So you're not getting into mental health. You know, I can kind of get off my soapbox on that, but it doesn't address any of that.
Yeah.
It just goes in. You need to be fingerprinted, all these things. And then it needs to be a searchable database. So it's registration as well. And you go through and just look down the line of people that oppose and groups that oppose and why. It's worth doing some research because the ads on TV, the ads are all purchased. So there aren't any more TV ads to go get. That's part of the reason we want to spread word of mouth, email, whatever we can do, mm-hmm. just to have people just read it, pay attention.
Yeah, educate yourself.
Look at it
yeah.
and read it and see what it's really about. Because it's not going to do the things that they say, but the TV ads are just very emotional. It's aimed at, does this seem like a bad thing to you? Then vote yes. And it's Oregon is one of, I think it's 21 states where you can go through and it's essentially, let me make sure I get this term right, but it's an initiated state statute. So the people initiated it. And there are 14 other states. Oregon's a direct initiated statute state, meaning it goes straight through and none of the political parties, no elected politician can do anything about it. And so there are 14 other states that can go the same way and 21 that have the same ability. So the people come through, sign a petition, get it on the ballot, and away it goes. And when they see it coming, as we're learning on our side, purchase up all of the media ahead of time so that you can't easily get your word out and say, this is what it's really about.
Right.
The capital of Oregon is Portland, right?
Salem.
I would think that if I were in the state of Oregon, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in that state that I'd be focused on, and I don't think gun violence is one of them. I don't think you guys have a gun violence problem there. But you do have a ton of other problems in the Portland area, which is homeless problems, drug use, prescription medication, addiction, things like that mm-hmm. that kill a ton of people each year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like ultimately it's like, I don't like talking about conspiracy theories, but like who's behind all this? Like there's some, it's just weird to me. Like what's the obsession? The obsession, like if you take firearms out of play, let's say every single firearm went away, what's the ultimate goal here? It's to disarm society, I think.
Correct. Yeah.
And I hate saying that because it just sounds completely insane. But like we live in the greatest nation in the world and like you have these factions of people. Who's behind it? Like what's, I don't understand that. I don't get it.
I don't either.
It's terrifying.
It is terrifying.
Yeah. So when does this come up for a vote?
So in Oregon, ballots are already out. Okay. So I've already voted. Mine's been cast, mailed, and counted, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's actually been counted, but you can track your ballots in Oregon. So the election is, the 8th Tuesday?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have time for that. Right now, honestly, going through and looking at it because of the way that it's been viewed, generally in Oregon, these things don't go very far. Oregon's a fantastic state. I know, you've got your views of what Portland, some of the stuff in Portland.
What the media portrays is like all the Antifa riots.
Well, it's Portland and Seattle give the whole area a whole feel. And when you're out kind of where I live or whatnot, it is not like boots on the ground, if you will. That's not the feel there.
Right.
Now, downtown Portland, that's...
Yeah, Washington and Oregon are they're predominantly agriculture.
If you look at the state, just on either of them, it kind of, you've got commercial fishing on the shore, on mm-hmm. the coast, logging, because there's a lot of mountains with logs, trees. And then you've got kind of the urban area right there along I-5, the mm-hmm. I-5 corridor. As you keep going east and push across, you get into ranching, farming, et cetera. And so Oregon, for example, has more huntable species than any other state in the lower 48.
Wow.
I think anywhere. I British Columbia may be the only, because we've got two different subspecies of elk, so Roosevelt and Rocky Mountain, four different types of deer between blacktail, Columbia whitetail, and mule deer. You start looking at the state is fantastic. And one of the reasons we're trying to do this, generally bills like this don't get through. Measures like this don't get through in Oregon. And this one is catching people off guard. And so I'm not super excited with kind of the industry's ability so far to just to rally, or the state. Maybe the state is probably a better way of phrasing that. because you call around like, oh, that'll never go through. We just pulled the poll numbers, and this is the scary part. So right now, 51 on the polls, 51% are supportive of this measure. So we're going to vote yes based on the polling.
That's terrifying.
And right now it's 39 that oppose and 10 that are undecided. Mm-hmm. Generally, these things in Oregon, I believe it's still open carry. Generally, fairly balanced when it comes to these types of things. This one has just been done in kind of a dirty, shady way. People don't know what they're voting for.
It feels sneaky.
Yeah.
Like they did it in the middle of the night and just kind of slid it in there.
Yep.
I think the number two industry in Oregon is cattle. Maybe the number. Ranching, I think it's a
big
massive industry.
So Les Schwab, do you guys have Les Schwab tire centers here?
Yeah.
So the Les Schwab tire ranch is Central Oregon. All the free beef, I don't know if you remember hearing those things, comes off mm-hmm. that ranch and other stuff.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they do. I remember that. Okay.
So Central Oregon, you get out there and, you know, for people that haven't been there, if you picture kind of Colorado mm-hmm. is kind of what a lot of Central Oregon, Central mm-hmm. Washington, you know, as well, more wheat fields and
greener.
Farm.
Slightly greener.
But it's, you know, it's not just this urban area. So it's a wonderful place.
Yeah, but there's a lot happening. Like, I, Phil Knight, the owner and founder of Nike, he's switched parties. Like, he's putting millions of dollars into what's the conservative, the Republican running for
Drazen,
governor?
Christine Drazen.
Yeah, like they're saying that like her numbers now, she has a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be the first Republican governor of Oregon since 1982, I think.
80, yeah.
Yeah, which
it was
is
early
like
80s.
40 years. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. So people are waking up. I mean, whenever Phil Knight, who's been diehard left his whole life, now he's shifting
he's
center to right.
Time to
yeah, things
see
are,
what else
things
can happen. Yeah.
That says
yeah.
a lot.
No, that's important. So what can people do? How can they educate themselves on this? What can they do?
Yeah, so that's the biggest question is what can we do now? And really it's just encourage people, especially people in Oregon, to read this, look at it, and really think about what you're accomplishing with a vote here, yes mm-hmm. or no. Once you do just a little bit of research on it and look at statements from like so Oregon State Sheriff's Association, for example, go in and just read their statement. They come out against it for these reasons, right? And they walk through it. Chiefs of police, and the list goes on and on and on and on. If you can just dig past the surface of the language that's on the ballot.
Yeah.
I'd love to say we can, you know, let's try to raise some funds and get some ads out there. The ship has kind of sailed, to be honest with you. So we're doing it through email, other things. Just as always, educate yourself before you vote.
Yeah.
But, you know, outside of Oregon, it still matters, right? So that was kind of I stumbled on the initiated statute piece, but it's not just Oregon. So it may be easy to say, well, that's Oregon. Mm-hmm. It's not. We're a very outdoor and hunting friendly type of a place. And this came straight up through a petition that works its way through and elected officials have nothing to do with it. It can happen lots of other places.
If it happens in Oregon, it's going to happen somewhere else. And it'll
the precedent is the problem.
Really soon.
Well, you got to wait for it to come. I mean, I'm right across the river.
Yeah.
It's a matter of time. Yeah. You know, so if you're aware of it, you understand it, you can at least have a heads up. And it's not a few, what are we? Yeah, we're just a few days from the election.
Yeah.
And they're not going to sneak it in next time around.
Right.
Yeah, so we got to get this episode out before the election.
We sure do.
Yeah, absolutely.
I might know a guy that could do that.
All right, so, yeah, they can.
Essentially, we want people spreading the word on just be educated on it, right? So I'm not here to tell anyone how they should vote. But I think that being educated on what it actually means and what it will accomplish on any measure, on any person, on a ballot matters. This one is just critical to.
So let's say it does get passed. Can it be undone?
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, it's going to be covered up in injunctions. It's unconstitutional. But that is going to be a mess to go back through. So I think that there is a long list of injunctions are ready to go. If this passes, it's gonna come in. Not a lawyer, so I don't know how all that works. But we've done a lot of research on what can we do. What happens? The best thing, hands down, is to get it voted down.
Right.
After that, we're not gonna give up. You know, and so there'll be injunctions, and it'll go into.
It's like
court.
Sports. You don't ever want to put it in the ref's hands. Win the game.
Win the game. Fantastic.
I know there's a federal judge somewhere that will strike this down immediately. And eventually, if it did pass, it would work its way to the Supreme Court, and it would get hammered. But you don't want that to happen. You know, win
right.
the game on your own. Don't hope for calls from the ref.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. All right. So, where can people find you? Where can they find Leupold?
So leupold.com is the easiest, L-E-U-P-O-L-D. And then so my email, they can hit me up on email or probably just coming in through the contact us on at leupold.com mm-hmm. is the best way. We can be reached at 1-800-LEUPOLD for some of the technical type questions. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're just trying to help. You know, that's probably the best way right now, website, okay. to be honest.
Very cool.
Outstanding. Thanks so much for coming.
Yeah. No, thank
appreciate
you.
Appreciate you. So thanks for putting the word out and educating everybody that's listening.
Set this stuff aside. We're really passionate about it, and it's just it's a dirty pool.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it comes down to.
All right. Cool, man. Well, thank you for coming, Tim.
Thanks for having
appreciate
me.
You. Yeah.